Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Breast Cancer. This is part two, so it's treatment of estrogen receptor, or ER-positive, and progesterone receptor, PR-positive breast cancer, and triple-negative breast cancer. So we have a lot to cover today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and about 40 other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 1,668 participants, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, and United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for this entire series, for supporting this series on breast cancer. Now, I want to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about the topics they'll be addressing, and there also is an evaluation form. And I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You know, when you think about it, your ideas and suggestions for us are invaluable as we move forward and plan future programs. And we are right now at the cusp of planning a whole bunch of programs for the next year, and we are really eagerly awaiting your suggestions of topics that you think would be most helpful to you. We take your recommendations very seriously, and we try very hard to include them in our programming. So tell us what you'd like, and we'll do our best to try to offer that. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. V.K. Gaddi, and Dr. Gaddi is he is Associate Professor of Medicine, Division of Oncology, University of Washington, Associate Member of Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Gaddi is going to address a number of topics with you, overview of ER-positive, PR-positive, and triple-negative breast cancer, understanding the role of diagnostic testing, the standard of care for ER and PR-positive breast cancer, and hormone therapy updates and targeted treatments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Gaddi.
Hi, thank you very much for the kind introduction, Carolyn. So I've been charged today with going over four topics, and I will try my best to go through these in an organized manner. I am going to move them around a little bit. I'm going to start first with an overview of ER-positive, PR-positive, and triple-negative breast cancer. So fundamentally, when cancers are first born, the vast majority of them try to use body's own natural hormones to help themselves grow. The one main hormone that helps most cancers and non-cancerous type situations grow is estrogen. The presence of these receptors for those hormones on the cancer cells is the first insight into knowing that these cancers may actually be using those hormones to help themselves grow. The two that we tend to focus on are these lady hormone receptors, the estrogen and progesterone. There's a third receptor that we see quite frequently, about 20 to 25% of the time also present, and that's the HER2 receptor. I believe that was the focus of a prior discussion, so I'll kind of defer on talking about that today. However, when none of these receptors are present, we have sort of a third term that we use, which is the triple negative breast cancer. My colleague, Dr. Carey, is going to speak more about that. But for the time being, know that most cancers like estrogen, and as a result, they express these receptors on their cell surface. And you can think of these receptors as grabbing these hormones, sucking them inside the cancer cell, and then using various pathways to help themselves grow using that estrogen. So logic would assume then, if you could somehow get rid of the estrogen, that would be very hurtful for these kinds of cancers. So that's a little foreshadowing of where we're going to go next, which is, what is the standard of care for ER-positive and progesterone receptor, or PR-positive breast cancers? In general, there's two strategies to get rid of estrogen. One is we can block those receptors or destroy them. And the quintessential medicine that does that is a medicine called tamoxifen. The other strategy is to somehow rid the estrogen itself. And the principal strategy to do that is to block an enzyme called aromatase, and therefore the medicines are called aromatase inhibitors. The aromatase enzyme basically is responsible for taking the last step of taking pre-estrogen and converting it into active estrogen, if you will. So when we block that enzyme, there's essentially very little estrogen left in the woman's body. So when we combine these two, when we compared these two strategies years and years ago to see which was better, it turned out quite consistently the strategy where we block the estrogen receptor, estrogen production with these aromatase inhibitors won. In other words, blocking the receptor seemed to be slightly inferior. So for many women, especially those who had postmenopausal breast cancer, this became the standard of care. However, in premenopausal women, this was somewhat of an unknown because it turns out if we give these aromatase inhibitors to premenopausal women, they can have certain complications. So as a result of that, we had not been practicing that. However, recently over the summer, we have some new data suggesting a way forward for how to give these medicines to premenopausal women. So I'm foreshadowing again, and I'll get to that topic in just a minute. So bottom line, for the time being, in postmenopausal women, the standard of care is to provide an aromatase inhibitor. The standard duration is 5 years. For premenopausal women, the standard of care had been giving 5 years of tamoxifen. However, in the very recent past, as of about 2 years ago, two large studies were published showing that 10 years of tamoxifen may be more beneficial than five. Although a bit controversial, the data were pretty clear that there was a benefit to doing that. I'm not sure that many doctors have started practicing in that way because there's still many questions, but I think it's not an unreasonable thing to offer 10 years of tamoxifen, and that could be considered the standard of care if one is getting tamoxifen. So moving forward then just a little bit, I'm going to focus a little bit on how we test for these things because this is also a quite rapidly evolving area. Standardly, historically, we would take a piece of tumor from a patient, we would cut it into very thin pieces and mount them onto these slides. Then we could use certain reagents to essentially paint the tumor tissue with various different reagents to look for various different things. So for example, we could use a technique called immunohistochemistry, which is essentially painting receptors such as the estrogen receptor, and we could say, oh look, it's present, therefore this cancer might care about estrogen, let's give this lady an anti-estrogen medicine. This is still the workhorse way of determining whether or not something is present or not. However, more recently, rather than looking for just whether or not the protein is or isn't there, we can start looking at how these cancers are constructed in the first place. And this is kind of the new role of genetics in cancer, and in particular breast cancer. We are now at a point where we can routinely look at several large numbers of genes that are present and messed up in the cancer cell. And we can do this by one of two ways. We can actually just read out the sequence of the genetic code for those cancers and see how they are different from the rest of the body's genetic codes, suggesting that those are mutations. Some of those mutations now we have a pretty good handle on as being associated with the progression or driving those breast cancers. And the logic there is that if we can target those mutations somehow, then we can kill these breast cancers. The other way that this kind of emerging genetics has evolved for us is that we can look at how much a certain gene is active. In other words, how high is it turned on or how high or how low is it turned off? And we can essentially make a portrait for every person's cancer for themselves. And we can take that portrait and compare it to other people's cancers, and that helps us say, oh, if this woman has this kind of portrait, then her cancer is more consistent with this other woman's very aggressive cancer for whom we knew what happened. Or we alternatively can say, oh, this portrait suggests a very favorable or low-risk situation, and in a woman like that, we may suggest that she doesn't need as much therapy as, say, the other woman did. There are several now tests of this nature that are available commercially. Many of you may have heard of these, the MammaPrint assay from a company called Agendia, the Oncotype DX assay from a company called Genomic Health, and then finally a newer test that's from the Seattle area, the NanoString assay has a test available in this space as well. So there's a lot of interest in developing these technologies to help more personalize the medical care being delivered for these breast cancer patients. And then finally, I'm going to just wrap up a little bit with some updates about some, in particular, hormone therapy updates that we have. I think thinking about this, this is, a very active field with lots of small studies suggesting potential ways forward. But two studies, or two projects in particular, I call them, look very interesting to me going forward. The first was presented at ASCO of this year, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, where very large studies are oftentimes presented to all the oncology community at large, and it's sort of a coming out party for these new ideas. And at the same time, this particular study I'm going to highlight was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And a moment ago, I mentioned that in premenopausal women, the standard of care has been to give only tamoxifen. But we've always wondered if we can also benefit these younger women by giving them one of these aromatase inhibitors. But the challenge, again, was some toxicities that emerged if we gave these to young women. So to get around those toxicities, we decided we could also give something called ovarian suppression. So these are medicines that are typically injections that are given once a month or maybe once every 3 months that basically turn the brain's connection off with the ovaries, essentially shutting down the ovaries. As a result, when the ovaries are out of the picture, this woman is essentially postmenopausal. And as a result, we can now give the aromatase inhibitors. So there were two studies of this kind that were both independently set up. And for this paper that was published and this presentation at ASCO, they combined the two groups from these trials and made a very large study with essentially 5,000 people, of which 4,000 fell into this category. And essentially the intervention was to give an ovarian suppression medicine combined with an aromatase inhibitor for 5 years versus an ovarian suppression medicine given with tamoxifen for 5 years. And at the end of the day, they asked the question, who did better? And quite simply put, the patients that got the aromatase inhibitor plus the ovarian suppression did better after about 5.5 years of follow-up than the patients who got ovarian suppression plus tamoxifen, suggesting that this more comprehensive path of shutting down estrogen made a difference. Now, I have to tell you, the differences were small. They were on the order of 4% different between the two groups. So one group had a 91% disease-free survival at 5 years, whereas the other one had 87. I know that may not sound like much, but for 1 in 25 patients to be benefited from this more comprehensive approach is a very exciting thing for medical oncologists like us. There were complications, and we can talk about that perhaps later, but in general, most of the complications were balanced between the two arms. It was very hard to see anything that was very different between the two sides. So one could consider this a new standard of care potentially for young women. The other program that looked interesting has been emerging over the last 2 or 3 years as well, and that's a different way to turn off hormone receptor pathways, hormone-activated cells. Rather than going after the hormone receptors themselves, there is a new medicine called palbociclib that looks to be able to shut off one of the internal machineries that are required for cancer cells to successfully divide. The pathway is called a cyclin DK4/6 pathway, and this medicine blocks that pathway. As a result, these women who get that medicine combined with an aromatase inhibitor in the metastatic setting appear to have very long and durable disease-free survival improvements over just trying the aromatase inhibitor by itself. So there's a lot of interest in this space as well, and I think in the coming year or two, we'll potentially see some exciting phase 3, very advanced data on how effective this combination could be. So I think that's my time. I'm going to pass the buck on to Dr. Newman next, I believe, and I'll be quiet until the time of the questions.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Gatti. That was really excellent. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Newman. Dr. Newman is Professor of Surgery, Director of Breast Care Center, University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Newman is going to address the role of surgery, triple-negative breast cancer, clinical trials, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Newman.
Good afternoon. It's such a pleasure to join the discussion today regarding management of breast cancer, and it's especially exciting to participate in a conversation related to these treatments as they pertain to specific subtypes or microscopic patterns of breast cancer. And indeed, as you will be hearing repeatedly throughout this teleconference, one of the most exciting advances in breast cancer research over the past several decades has been our recognition of the fact that breast cancer is not one single disease, but it actually includes a spectrum of subtypes that might have varying degrees of biologic aggressiveness, and these different subtypes have different therapeutic options. But I do want to emphasize here that even though some subtypes, such as the triple-negative tumors, tend to be more aggressive than others, we do have very powerful, very effective treatments for all of the different breast cancer patterns or subtypes. And this is why the majority of our breast cancer patients today will have a very good outcome. Early detection of breast cancer is critical regardless of the pattern or the subtype of breast cancer that a woman is diagnosed with. And as a surgical breast oncologist, I am often seeing patients when they are first diagnosed. And so these types of messages about breast health awareness, breast cancer screening, and early detection are truly near and dear to my heart. Now, my job in discussing the surgical plan with a newly diagnosed breast cancer patient is also going to be influenced by this issue, this discussion of breast cancer subtypes. And this discussion actually begins even before the breast cancer diagnosis has been established, because the type of biopsy that a woman undergoes when she is first found to have a breast abnormality will be critical in ensuring that appropriate subtype or breast cancer pattern information is available. The most efficient way to establish a new breast cancer diagnosis is usually going to be via a core needle biopsy, which extracts just thin strands or fragments of tissue from a particular lesion in a woman's breast. Now, often these core needle biopsies are performed by the radiologist, who might use either breast ultrasound or mammograms to guide the biopsy needle into the appropriate area or abnormality in that woman's breast. Sometimes the needle biopsy is performed by a surgeon, somebody like me, who will insert the device freehand into a lump that we feel or that we palpate in a woman's breast. These are efficient diagnostic procedures because they can often be performed in the clinic. They are outpatient procedures performed under local lidocaine anesthetic. Now, this needle biopsy material is then analyzed under the microscope by the pathologist, who will render a diagnosis regarding whether or not a cancer is identified in the biopsy material. If so, then the molecular marker information on that cancer is going to be essential. The molecular marker information that we typically will look for are the markers estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the HER2 new marker. It is essential that the surgeon reviews this biopsy material very carefully to make sure that the report provides an accurate and reasonable explanation for whatever the target abnormality was being biopsied to begin with. If the needle biopsy, for whatever reason, was inadequate in explaining the abnormality that was identified in that woman's breast, then the patient does need to be brought to the operating room to undergo a surgical biopsy. And with a surgical biopsy, an actual incision will be made on the woman's breast, and a larger sample of breast tissue will be removed and sent to the pathologist for microscopic evaluation. Now, once either the needle biopsy or the surgical biopsy specimen confirms the presence of the cancer, the surgeon, again, must be very careful about interpreting the pathology report and making sure that the pattern of the cancer is clearly described, and to make sure that there is adequate information regarding the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 new marker for any abnormalities that might be present in the woman's breast. This is important because some patients will actually have multiple tumors in the breast, or they might have a combination of invasive infiltrating cancer as well as some pre-malignant or pre-invasive cancer, a biopsy report that we often call ductal carcinoma in situ. Now, in these cases, with a combination of pathology findings, the surgeon has to be very sure that the molecular marker information is evaluated for all of the relevant areas of invasive cancer in that woman's breast. Now, once the definitive cancer diagnosis is established, the surgeon will go on to explain the actual surgical treatment options to the patient, and sometimes these treatment options will be influenced by the molecular marker patterns that have also been identified. In general, however, regardless of breast cancer pattern or breast cancer subtype, the goals of the surgical management will be threefold. First, the surgeon needs to be sure that he or she has removed the clinically apparent or the clinically obvious areas of disease in the woman's breast, defined as any cancerous lumps and or any abnormal or cancerous areas appearing on that woman's mammogram or ultrasound images. Second goal is to make sure that the entire breast is treated somehow so that the woman has eradication or treatment of any microscopic invisible areas of cancer hiding in other parts of her breast separate from the obvious cancerous lump. The third goal is to evaluate the lymph nodes or the glands in the underarm area, the area that we call the axilla. Now, the first two issues, making sure that the cancerous lump has been removed and treating the entire breast, these two issues will be addressed by either mastectomy with complete removal of the breast or by breast-saving, breast-conserving surgery. With the breast-saving or breast-conserving surgery, we perform a lumpectomy, and the lumpectomy would then be followed by radiation treatments to the entire breast to eliminate or to sterilize any of the microscopic disease hiding in other parts of that woman's breast. For the women who do undergo mastectomy, we try whenever possible to have those patients meet with the plastic surgeons so that they can then be evaluated for their breast reconstruction options. And a lot of the breast reconstruction that we performed is actually performed at the same time as the mastectomy. This is what we call immediate breast reconstruction. It's very, very important for breast cancer patients to understand that survival from breast cancer is exactly the same regardless of whether the woman undergoes breast-conserving surgery or mastectomy. And this is because survival from breast cancer will generally depend upon whether or not that particular cancer has the biologic capacity to metastasize or to spread to other organs in the body, such as the liver, lungs, bones, and to ultimately damage those other organs. Now, surgery to the breast is still very important, very necessary, because we don't want any of our patients to have uncontrolled growth of the cancerous lump on the chest wall. But in general, the life-threatening aspect of breast cancer is going to be related to the risk of metastatic spread to other organs. And this is why most patients with breast cancer will require addressing that third goal, a procedure to evaluate the lymph nodes of the axilla, the underarm area. The axillary staging procedure is sometimes done as a needle biopsy. Sometimes it's done as a small procedure to remove some of the lymph nodes in the underarm area called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. In some women, we have to do a more extensive operation called an axillary lymph node dissection, where we basically excise in an anatomically designed fashion the entire fat pad of the underarm area. This is what the axillary lymph node dissection is. Now, the lymph node staging procedure is going to be necessary because if we do find that there are cancer cells hiding in these glands of the underarm, then right away we have an extremely powerful clue that the woman might also have cancer cells hiding in other parts of her body, such as those other organs, the liver, lungs, bones. And these microscopic amounts of cancer will usually be invisible on special X-ray studies such as CAT scans, bone scans, and such. Now, seeing clues that the cancer is hiding in other parts of the body does not mean that the cancer is untreatable, but it does mean that we will want to be somewhat more aggressive about treating that cancer with medical treatments, such as endocrine treatments that you heard from by Dr. Gotti, or by treatments such as chemotherapy. These systemic or medical treatments will often be successful at completely eliminating or sterilizing the cancer in other organs of the woman's body, and therefore contributing to survival, continuing to allow that woman to live a long, healthy life. Now, we also obtain clues regarding whether or not these medical or systemic therapies are going to be necessary by studying the microscopic pattern or the molecular marker information of that breast cancer based upon studying the surgical biopsy specimen and based upon looking at the size of the cancer. And this, of course, brings us right back to the very important discussion of breast cancer subtypes and the molecular markers, estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the HER2-new marker. As we are all aware, breast cancers that are negative for all three of these markers are commonly called the triple negative breast cancers. And it's true that triple negative tumors do tend to be more aggressive than non-triple negative breast cancers, and so we do tend to be more likely to recommend chemotherapy for these tumors. These tumors will not respond to endocrine therapies or to anti-HER2-new targeted therapies. But there are some patterns or subsets of triple negative tumors that are less aggressive than others. And also, if we catch a triple negative tumor when it is extremely small and with negative lymph nodes, then sometimes we can still avoid chemotherapy altogether. And so it's very important for the surgical breast oncologist to work closely with the medical breast oncologist and the pathologist to get as much information as possible regarding the comprehensive treatment plan, treatment needs for any individual patient. For some cases of triple negative cancer, we can actually tell as soon as the woman has been diagnosed that chemotherapy will be very important for her. Sometimes this is based upon the size of the cancerous lump in the breast or by the appearance of the axillary lymph nodes. And if we do see evidence right off the bat that chemotherapy will be important in that woman's care, we will sometimes consider that the woman is a candidate for receiving chemotherapy before her definitive surgery, and this is what we call neoadjuvant or preoperative chemotherapy. We routinely consider this option in women who have large, bulky cancers or locally advanced breast cancers, but sometimes with even relatively smaller cancers of the breast that are triple negative, we will consider giving neoadjuvant chemotherapy to shrink that tumor down and to make the woman a better lumpectomy candidate. The triple negative tumors actually tend to be exquisitely sensitive to shrinkage by neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and so this is a fairly common strategy for these types of tumors. If the woman is going to receive chemotherapy before her surgery, she and her surgeon need to be absolutely sure that some type of clip or marker has been left in place at the biopsy site, because if the chemotherapy completely melts away all of the visible evidence of the cancer, the surgeon needs this marker in place so that he or she knows where to perform the lumpectomy in that woman's breast. And so to summarize and to conclude, there are clearly a variety of surgical treatments and sequences that a newly diagnosed breast cancer patient needs to consider in order to totally process and understand all of these options. She needs to work very closely with her multidisciplinary team, not just the surgeon, but also the medical oncologist, sometimes involving the radiation oncologist right off the bat, to figure out the best options for that individual patient. And so I will close here. I again thank everybody for their time and attention, and I'll turn the program back over to Dr. Messner and to my colleague panelists, who are a wonderful, wonderful panel of experts, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Newman. That was really wonderfully informative. It was just terrific. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Lisa Carey. Dr. Carey is the Richardson and Marilyn Jacobs Prior Distinguished Professor in Breast Cancer Research. Division Chief, Hematology and Oncology, Physician in Chief, North Carolina Cancer Hospital, Medical Director, UNC Breast Cancer, Breast Center, Associate Director for Clinical Research, UNC Lineberger. And Dr. Carey is going to address treatment updates for triple negative breast cancer, how research contributes to your care, clinical trial updates, practical tips to cope with treatment side effects, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Carey.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be able to participate in this, and I think that my predecessors have actually set up the talk that I'm about to give quite well. Specifically, Dr. Newman, I think, really introduced for triple-negative breast cancer the key kind of local therapy options, specifically about how surgical management is performed. But I think one of the key takeaway elements of her talk moving into mine is a key treatment update of triple negative and, to be honest, all of the other kinds of breast cancer is that it is increasingly key to have it done in a multidisciplinary way so that your surgeon, your medical oncologist, and your radiation oncologist are talking to each other and making decisions in a coherent fashion to optimize the care. If you then think of the medical oncologist's role in this, you know, in truth, regardless of the timing of therapy, and she outlined the neoadjuvant or preoperative approach to giving the medical therapy for stages 1 through 3 triple negative breast cancer, whether you do it before surgery or after surgery, actually, it's one important thing to remember is that actually the patients do just as well 5-10 years later. And in fact, we use very, very standard regimens that are well accepted and are, as she mentioned, very effective. We have, and anyone who has been through this knows that there are these different regimens that have varying side effects and varying levels of aggressiveness. They are all very safe, but they all differ to some degree or another, and which one is chosen really depends in part on the extent of the cancer, the health of the patient, and a variety of other issues that the medical oncologist takes into account. It should be noted that for triple negative breast cancer, which again is defined by what it's not, it's defined by not having hormone receptors on it, the kind of cancers that Dr. Gotti was talking about, by not having HER2, that protein, on it, which means that it really lacks the known targetable proteins that we have in breast cancer, which means that we are completely reliant from the standpoint of standard of care on chemotherapy. The good news is there are a lot of different regimens. As I mentioned, from stages 1 through 3, the neoadjuvant or adjuvant drugs are very well established. And in fact, the advances in chemotherapy that have been done in the last few years have benefited triple negative breast cancer as much, if not more, than any other subtype of breast cancer. A couple of questions are still outstanding in terms of chemotherapy for early breast cancer. One of them, for example, is whether or not we should move beyond the standard drugs, which are drugs like adriamycin or doxorubicin, or the taxane-type drugs like docetaxel, also known as Taxotere, or paclitaxel, also known as Taxol. Those are the standard drugs that are pretty much given in various combinations to most patients with stages 1 through 3 breast cancer. One of the things that our biology colleagues have been helping us with is identifying molecular subsets within triple-negative breast cancer and a suggestion that we might be able to be a little more targeted in our use of chemotherapy drugs. And the specific drug that often comes up is carboplatin. And that's true for both stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. But it's particularly important to note that that some of the recent studies that were neoadjuvant in nature did show that if you added a drug called carboplatin to the standard drugs in triple-negative breast cancer, it augmented the shrinkage of the tumor in the breast and the number of patients in whom that tumor in the breast had been eradicated by the drugs. The however here, and I'm going to say that for many of us for patients who have locally advanced breast cancer, we do use drugs like carboplatin or cisplatin. For patients who have metastatic disease, we certainly use them. But what we don't know about these drugs is in stages 1 through 3 if they actually help improve outcome. We don't know that shrinkage of the tumor in the breast necessarily is going to help women do better in the long term. So I think there are a lot of questions that are still existing, so I wouldn't consider these to be completely standard of care. in stage 4 breast cancer or metastatic breast cancer, where the cancer has spread to other parts of the body beyond the breast and the lymph nodes in the armpit, we have multiple options. And it's important to notice that the kind of drugs that we use for stages 1 through 3 are very different than the drugs we use in stages 4. They're all chemotherapy, that's true. But the goals of treatment in stage 4 is really disease control and tolerability. What we're trying to accomplish is for the patient to receive the drugs and to be able to live her life well. We typically use one drug at a time. Occasionally in symptomatic or very aggressive tumors, we do use more than one chemotherapy drug at a time, but whenever possible, we use one at a time. And we match up the drug to the best responses that have been seen in clinical trials, as well as the type of side effects that those drugs produce. And I might give for an example a patient who already has diabetes and some trouble with neuropathy, we might not choose a drug for which neuropathy is a particularly notable side effect. We might choose a drug that avoids neuropathy altogether. By the same token, patients who struggle with maybe nausea, we have drugs that are far less likely to produce that kind of a side effect. And in the stage 4 setting, we may be reliant on chemotherapy, but we have very good drugs that we can choose that have, effectiveness and have different side effects that we can pair up the side effect profile, the response likelihood with the patient. And I think that's a very key element about the care of patients in the metastatic setting. I think one of the things that highlights also is the importance of clinical trials in this. As I mentioned, chemotherapy is the mainstay of treatment for triple-negative breast cancer, regardless of stage. However, we'd like to have targeted therapy for triple-negative breast cancer, and there are a number of really exciting approaches and drugs that are currently being tested. None are yet proven, but there are, I think at the last time I checked, there were about 130 open clinical trials, many of which were trying to take advantage of some of the kinds of technologies that Dr. Gotti mentioned, where we're trying to be more sophisticated on a molecular level and learning to pair up the Achilles heel of the tumor with the drugs that are being developed. And I think you'll hear in the upcoming months and years more about strategies trying to leverage how we can be smarter about the nature of the underlying cancer and match up the problem of the cancer specifically within a patient in a personalized way. I think the next element of this that is probably very important because it just came out and it's not specific to triple negative is kind of a good news story, which is we, for many years, because of the nature of clinical trials, we oftentimes don't have a lot of information about how patients who have very, very small node negative breast cancers do. And so, as many people have commented, the truth is that we give a lot of drugs to people in stages 1 through 3 in our efforts to treat them better and to improve their outcome, but we know that for some women we're not doing enough for them because the cancer recurs regardless of those treatments, and in many other women, probably many, many more other women, we're actually over-treating them. They don't need as many drugs as we're giving, and some of them don't need them at all. One of the things that some of the personalized approaches that Dr. Gotti touched on that are particularly relevant for hormone receptor positive breast cancer, those are efforts to try and be more thoughtful in assigning chemotherapy to patients who truly need it. We don't have that kind of genetic test on the tumor that we can do for triple negative breast cancer. However, some recent studies that looked at very small tumors that were node negative and were a centimeter or smaller actually suggest that even in triple negative breast cancer and also HER2 positive breast cancer, they seem to do very well even without chemotherapy. So for patients in those categories, I think more and more oncologists may in fact be having a balanced discussion with the patient about whether or not chemotherapy is even needed, including for triple-negative breast cancer. I have to say that in my own clinical experience, many patients arrive to my clinic having read a lot on the Internet about the biology of triple-negative breast cancer and feel that they're almost predestined to relapse. And the truth is that that simply isn't the case. Many patients, if not most triple-negative breast cancer patients, actually do quite well. I think the last thing I wanted to comment, which I think is particularly relevant about triple-negative breast cancer because of our reliance on chemotherapy for treatment, are two things. The first is that chemotherapy that we give now is not the same as chemotherapy that we gave 10 or 20 years ago. First off, there are many, many more drugs. And secondly, we are far better able to manage the side effects of these drugs. The anti-nausea regimens that we use routinely are far, far superior and, in fact, are largely successful. The management of low blood counts, particularly low white cells and infection risk, is much, much better with the advent of drugs that specifically support the bone marrow. And the second part is whatever side effect you are having, it is also incredibly clear that the nature of modern oncology care is part of a team approach. And one of the components of that is the physician. Another component are the nursing staff and the other support people. And the last one, of course, is the patient. You know, quality of life throughout cancer care, you know, is a very multifaceted thing. You know, it's spiritual, it's physical, it's social, it's psychological. And attention, you know, clearly needs to be paid to all of these things. We know now that, in fact, attention to symptom management actually helps people live longer, you know, as a separate component of their care. And so one of the practical tips for patients who are going through any kind of therapy, chemotherapy or not, for cancer, you know, a strong recommendation is to really take advantage of opportunities to communicate and to improve the communication skills with the care team, and not just wait for the next, you know, physician visit to bring things up, and to be quite honest about the symptoms that a patient might be having. You know, one of the last thing I will mention, because I think it's really important and it is an emerging area that will affect all of our patients in a very positive way, is the idea of patient-reported outcomes. Increasingly so, these are tools that are being incorporated into clinics for patients to have be empowered to identify and report the nature of and the quantity of symptoms they might be having. It gives a much better opportunity for the caregiving team to address these. And in fact, studies have been done that show that these improve symptom control. They, you know, improve the number of different measures that are used to try and work with symptom management and quality of life considerations, and they improve patient satisfaction. And I think you'll see a transformation in the way we do communicate about quality of life and symptom management in the upcoming years as a far more standard incorporation into cancer care.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Carey. That was an outstanding presentation, and I know a lot of issues that you raised will be questions during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thanks so much. And our next speaker is Allison Nielsen. Allison is an oncology social worker. She's coordinator of Women's Cancers Program at Cancer Care. And Ms. Nielsen will address Cancer Care's free psychosocial support services offered by our professionally trained oncology social workers and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Nielsen, who actually is following up with Dr. Carey's comments about the importance of the psychosocial aspect also in coping with breast cancer. Ms. Nielsen?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a privilege to be on the program today. I'm an oncology social worker, and I work with many women and their loved ones who are coping with breast cancer. I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways in which we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone impacted by cancer. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally. Support groups offered face-to-face in the New York City area and over the telephone or online nationwide. Education about resources and navigating the healthcare system. Practical help and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in the ways in which a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her whole world. They are experienced in helping cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, including the financial demands, physical changes, working with the medical team, social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. You may feel the need to stay strong or push away uncomfortable feelings, but even the strongest person cannot handle cancer all by herself. The good news is that you do not have to walk this path alone. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is actually a sign of strength and courage. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation, where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about cancer. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice your concerns and learn ways to cope with the diagnosis. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience, and feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a support group over the telephone for women with metastatic breast cancer. There are also online groups available for women with both early stage and metastatic or stage 4 breast cancer. And women with cancer in the New York tri-state area can take advantage of our in-person support groups. Other group members with breast cancer can offer valuable insight based on their personal experience. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our comprehensive website at www.cancercare.org. And finally, we recognize that women with triple-negative breast cancer have unique needs. The Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation has partnered with Cancer Care to offer free professional support services to anyone coping with a diagnosis of triple-negative breast cancer. The TNBC helpline is staffed by experienced oncology social workers with specific knowledge of triple negative disease. To speak with one of our expert social workers, please call 877-880-TNBC. I'd also like to mention that we're recruiting for an online support group specifically for women with triple negative breast cancer. There's still time to sign up, and I encourage you to register online at cancercare.org/support_groups. As we have learned a lot from today's Living with Breast Cancer program, you might need some assistance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Cancer Care Services are here to help you through. Thank you so much for your attention, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. That was wonderful, and thank you for all the wonderful information. Now we have time for questions, and we have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, if we do not get to your question, please contact us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again, so that none of you feel like you didn't get your questions addressed. But, Stephanie, why don't we do the best we can and take as many as we can, and if you would bring on board all of our speakers so we can address the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Jennifer Kay. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I wanted to just say that this was extremely informative. I'm an oncology social worker. I work at a hospital on Long Island, and I also do private practice only for women with breast cancer. And I was just curious. I know that there is a lot of talk about triple negative and ER positive, PR positive, and HER2, negative or positive. I happen to have a patient who is triple positive, and I just wanted to get from the doctor's perspective, how common is this?
Thank you for that excellent question, Jennifer. And Dr. Carey, do you want to address that?
Sure. So HER2-positive breast cancer is about 20% of breast cancers, and about half of those are also hormone receptor positive. So it's not the most common subset, but it's certainly a very, you know, commonly encountered one. I think we saw three of them earlier today. So the fact is that that's a group of patients for whom you have, you know, multiple options from a treatment standpoint, because they have hormone receptors that are targetable, they have HER2 that is targetable, and chemotherapy, of course, you know, crosses all tumor types in terms of having an effect.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Melissa F. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I am an ERPR ovarian cancer survivor. What? And I'm piggybacking on your information. I was wondering if you could repeat for me, the first speaker. There was a new medication out there. Started with Talbo. Just wondering if you can give me that name again.
Certainly, Melissa. Thank you. Dr. Gaddy, if you could address the question.
Sure. Congratulations on surviving both those cancers. Estrogen and progesterone receptors are positive, as we discussed, on a large number of breast cancers, and it turns out beyond just targeting those receptors, people have been interested in targeting other pathways. It's emerged that these cellular machinery pathways known as cyclins are targetable, and the first drug that looks effective in that space is called palbociclib, PALBOCICLIB. That's based on phase 2 studies. We have some phase 3 studies that are cooking right now, and we hope to have data for people with those in the next few months to years.
So that's actually in a clinical trial right now phase, is that correct?
Correct.
And where would that be? Where are those trials taking place? Or
all over the world.
Okay. So that would be a good question to ask one's healthcare provider. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. We have another question from one of our online participants. With so many to choose from, how does my doctor determine which treatment to recommend? Now, I realize this is a huge question, but I'm wondering if, Dr. Carey, if you could just comment on that, because I realize that would be a whole course or probably all years of medical school and all of this, but just something to help people to understand how these choices are made.
Well, you know, in what we call early breast cancer, or stages 1 through 3, I mean, in truth, the medical therapies are really dictated by the places where we have good medical evidence. So, you know, the kind of treatments that are used in terms of targeting hormone receptors, how long you take anti-estrogen drugs, and what kind of HER2 targeting drugs, and for how long you take it, and what kind of chemotherapy, and for how long you take it, these are all essentially recipes that have been tested. And so typically physicians, you know, use evidence-based medicine to guide the treatment options. Within those regimens that are accepted, there are some, you know, there are some menu options, and those are usually driven by the nature of the cancer, both clinically, you know, what the risk is of it, and trying to match up the patient's other health issues with, you know, the right drugs. I think when you get away from those menus that are really what we call adjuvant or neoadjuvant regimens, the other category is treatment for stage 4 breast cancer patients or metastatic breast cancer patients. And in that setting, you know, as I said earlier, the choice is really made, you know, as a partnership. Between the, you know, taking into account what's available. So triple negative breast cancer, we have, you know, the menu of options is chemotherapy options. For the other subtypes, we have targeted options in addition to. And, you know, it depends in part on what are appropriate and available and what matches up with the patient. And let me use as a for example, if we went to that triple positive patient that was just asked about, you know, if you're a triple-positive metastatic breast cancer patient, one easy option might be to start with anti-estrogen therapies because they are typically very easily tolerated, they're oral, they don't involve having to be in the clinic a lot, et cetera. HER2 targeting is, you know, for the most part infusional, can be added in there. It does make it a little bit more complicated in terms of lifestyle and taking into account those sorts of things, but are usually very well tolerated and don't have a lot of side effects. And then chemotherapy gets managed in the ways I mentioned before, where it depends on what the things that are, you know, some patients have had chemo before, and they say, listen, I always get sick when I have chemo. So you try and choose things that are less likely to produce that particular side effect. Or they say, I really, you know, right now in my life, it's really important to me that I not lose my hair. And we have some drugs that do and some drugs that don't. So that becomes much more of a discussion. So there are guidelines about, you know, what drugs we think may be better early rather than later. But there is much more discretion. I think there's a lot more art to that particular decision-making process.
Thank you. And we have a question actually from Patricia. I have taken Femara for 5 years, and now my oncologist explains 5 more years are suggested. I would appreciate your thoughts. Dr. Gaddy, would you want to address that?
Sure. So the data we have so far was developed as follows for endocrine therapy. Initially, we started off with 5 years of tamoxifen. And when we decided that aromatase inhibitors would be an interesting type of medicine to consider, we did studies where we did 5 years of tamoxifen versus 5 years versus any one of these aromatase inhibitors. And as I discussed, the aromatase inhibitors, quote, won those trials. Around the same time those studies were being performed, additional studies were being done to see if 10 years of tamoxifen was better than 5 years of tamoxifen. And as we just learned in the last 2 years, it looks like 10 years, quote, wins over 5 years. There was also an additional study where people were given 5 years of tamoxifen, and then after completing the 5 years of tamoxifen, they could do 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. And in that study, doing the 5 additional years of an aromatase inhibitor was better than not doing it. So for the question specifically asked here, however, I'd have to say we don't have any strong or compelling evidence just yet. Right now, 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor is the standard. There's really not a whole lot of data out there to suggest 5 years of anything beyond that is necessary. And moreover, I think, and the more key issue is we don't have safety data for that recommendation either. We believe these medicines are safe for 5 years, and we just don't know for 10 years. But, gosh, I don't personally recommend 10 years of an aromatase inhibitor at this point to very many people at all, just in a handful of situations where we're worried about something. So the standard is not to provide more than 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor.
Excellent. Thank you. And again, we always recommend people can consider getting a second opinion or perhaps discuss with their physician why they're recommending the particular treatment they are. So hopefully that will be helpful as well. And there is one last question from one of our online participants, and that is a question about having hot flashes at night that are causing a person to lose sleep. And so, Dr. Carrie, could you just address that issue? I know it's a common concern for many patients.
Yeah, you know, menopausal symptoms are troubling, you know, regardless of whether they're helped along by the anti-estrogen drugs that we give or not. I think, you know, for many people, there are sort of lifestyle approaches. You know, there's, you know, the layering of clothing, chillos, which are sort of things you can put around your neck that cool you off, and things like that are certainly helpful. There are, you know, medical approaches that can be used. There's a drug called venlafaxine, also known as Effexor, which can be very, very helpful at low doses in alleviating these, as are a couple of other drugs that are used more for their sort of neurologic diseases, like a drug called gabapentin that can be helpful. So I think being honest and trying things, you know, with your doctor, kind of supervising. I think you can start with lifestyle approaches, but I think if it's interfering with sleep, that's the trigger for trying medical management.
Excellent. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've been outstanding. This is quite an amazing team of speakers. I also want to thank all of you who've been asking such great questions, both online and on the telephone, and also those of you who actually are listening. I do want to repeat that if we did not get to your question or you think of a question, please call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And our staff of oncology social workers are here to answer your questions and help you. Most importantly, as we conclude our call today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with breast cancer or in coping with cancer in general. I want you to know that you have access to cancer care. You have access to all of our staff here, all of our oncology social workers. As you heard, Allison's one of our oncology social workers, all here to help you. And you can call our helpline, that 1-800-813-HOPE number, and our staff are here to help you. And what do we help you with? Just to, again, repeat that quickly for all of you. So we're here to listen to you, to hear your concerns, and to try to help you with your questions. We provide counseling services. We offer support groups on the telephone online. All of that service is free. We also offer financial assistance and with various needs that you may have, and we also assist with a co-payment assistance program. And we have lots of materials and publications, a very active website, and, of course, these workshops as well. So you have a whole menu of things to choose from, and I would ask you to call us, and you can either use all of them or one of them, whatever best fits your needs. But they're all there for you as you need them. I want to thank all of you for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.